I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. John Lennon said of Chuck Berry, if you try to give rock and roll another name, you might call it Chuck Berry. This hour, we pay tribute to the legendary musician, the man who didn't stop rocking until the moon went down. Chuck Berry died on Saturday at the age of 90. Our guests this hour include Ed Ward, known as Public Radio's rock and roll historian. His new book is titled The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920 to 63, also author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. Tim Miller joining us in our studios here in Milwaukee, professor in the Department of Music at UW-Milwaukee. He teaches musicology and ethnomusicology. And Michael Hawkeye Herman will join us, a blues music performer, composer, songwriter, educator, historian, and journalist. And he has recorded several of Chuck Berry's songs. We're going to start the hour, of course, with a song. And it's a song that is now in deep space. More on that in just a moment. It is considered Chuck Berry's greatest song about rock and roll. Said that Chuck Berry invented the idea of rock and roll. The most important thing that Berry gave us was an idea. He was all of the people there when rock was formed. He was the only one who not only wrote most of his own material, but wrote substantive material. And the music meant something. He intuited that the music was bigger than any of its practitioners, bigger than anything that had come before. Great body of work we'll be talking about this hour as we look at Chuck Berry this hour of the program. And we'll be welcoming your phone calls for all of our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is ideas@wpr.org. Facebook page, we love to read your comments always, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Let's introduce our guest. Ed Ward is a writer and radio commentator known as Public Radio's rock and roll historian. He has a new book, The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920 to 1963, also author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He's written for Rolling Stone Magazine, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and many music magazines, and is one of the original founders of Austin's South by Southwest Music Festival. Ed, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi. Pleased to be here.
Hi, Ed. Great to have you with us. Tim Miller is joining us in our studios in Milwaukee, professor in the Department of Music at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He teaches musicology and ethnomusicology and is director of the school's Collegium Musicum. Professor Miller, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Kathleen.
We're going to have some fun this hour. Michael Hawkeye Herman is also joining us. He's joining us from Oregon. He is a blues music performer, a composer, a songwriter, educator, historian, and journalist, the recipient of the International Blues Foundation's Lifetime Achievement Award for his work in keeping the blues alive through education. And in 2004, he was inducted into the Iowa Blues Hall of Fame. Michael, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you, all of you, with us this hour. What about this idea? He's been called the founder of rock and roll, but it was this idea of rock and roll that a lot of people have written about it. It was something different. It was more than the lyrics. It was a spectacular idea. Ed, do you want to start?
Well, I don't think you can call anybody the founder of rock and roll. I mean, it was a concept that sort of coalesced over time, and suddenly people looked at it and went, wow, there's something here.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think anybody can be claimed as an inventor. There were many, many contributors before and even after Chuck Berry came onto the scene.
Michael, we played Johnny B. Goode at the top of the show. You remind us, I love this story about where that song is right now. It's way out there.
Yeah, that's right. Carl Sagan and I think one of his assistants selected about 30 songs to go on a golden record to go on the Voyager 1 space probe in 1977. And the only rock and roll song that they selected was Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode, although there it is said that they also selected Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles, but EMI, the producers, didn't want it on there. So the only rock and roll song that's traveling through space is Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode. And, of course, the joke is that if any aliens out in deep space would ever listen and receive that golden record, that they would probably send a message to Earth that would say, please send more Chuck Berry.
Or maybe they would even come down here because they like the music so much. They'd want to find out what we're all about.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He was, Tim, let's talk to you for a moment about the combination of gifts that he had. He was a great lyricist. He was also one heck of a musician.
Yeah, and I want to echo what Ed said here in this idea of Chuck Berry inventing something out of thin air, which is really not what happened. It's maybe better to think of him as an innovator. And if you think about him as an innovator, that puts him right in the same conversation you're having about Mozart, about Beethoven, about the Beatles, about anybody who came after that. He took a combination of elements that were already there, tweaked them, interjected his own personality, and was able to go from there. So, yeah, one of the big things that he's important with, if we look at what rock and roll is that this combination of music that had been traditionally done by black performers, which in that time we're talking about R&B, at least that's what the Billboard charts called it, and then white music, which at that point was country. It's a lot more complicated than that, of course. But bringing these two elements together, and you know, he talks in his memoir about how he was playing basically hillbilly songs for his black audience, and that was one way he was interjecting these different ideas. But then he comes in a context where the industry had a practice in the early 50s, and you can read about this in Ed's book, where there were cover songs being made. So say we had a hit in the top 10 of R&B, the music industry people in New York would go, oh, that song's pretty good. Let's get somebody like Pat Boone to sing it. And then all of a sudden they'd have a million-selling, you know, top 10 single in the pop charts. And there was a lot of money involved in that because the property of what the music was whoever held the copyright for the song. So Chuck Berry comes along, and I think as Ed said right earlier, he's one of the first people who really comes in as somebody writing their own material, performing their own material, and being themselves the force that's crossing over between these different pockets of music consumership. So he's really creating what rock and roll was, and sometimes scholarly people, we make a distinction between rock and roll as this thing from the late 50s into the early 60s, and then rock, which kind of came after, right, and it's more a big umbrella term. Mm-hmm. And rock and roll, it was this, at the beginning, white performers doing black music, and here we come along and get Chuck Berry, Fats Domino, Little Richard, really consciously looking at what the reasons were that those cover songs were able to be made, and the reason that the mainstream market was valuing these different versions and going, hey, I can do that myself. I can write a song that has a different set of themes. I can present myself in a different way. Chuck Berry will talk about singing with a different accent for his own audience. So he was very shrewd and really knew what he was doing, both in terms of constructing his material and then the presentation, of course. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can talk to some of the other
absolutely
people about the...
Michael, for a moment, tell me about, you play the guitar, you're a blues guitarist, a performer. Tell me about his technique. Was he doing something different? Is there something wonderful about the way he plays the guitar?
Well, going along with what both Jim and Ed said, that as an artist, nobody comes along in a vacuum. It doesn't matter what art that you practice or you want to go into. We all stand on the shoulders of those that came before us so that we can see further. And Chuck definitely did that. He idolized, not surprisingly, if we were going to talk about founders of rock and roll, he idolized the music of Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five. Louis Jordan was known as the king of the jukebox, and he wrote extremely funny and contemporary lyrics, and he had many, many hits. So that's why he was known as the king of the jukebox. And Chuck Berry really paid attention to the the boogie music that Louis Jordan created in the post-war era that made him the first star to actually make videos that appeared on these video jukeboxes. And then as far as the guitar playing goes, Chuck listened and was influenced deeply, as all blues musicians were, by T-Bone Walker.
Mm-hmm.
T-Bone Walker is the main influence of B.B. King and almost all well-known blues musicians, whether it's Stevie Ray Vaughan or Robert Cray. Everyone points to T-Bone Walker as being the main influence in their guitar playing and their approach to the guitar. And in terms of what Chuck did specifically, without getting too technical about the music, is that he heard T-Bone. He heard the way T-Bone bent the strings and played extended chords, and he played two note licks that previously were not that popular. He even played an F-hole Gibson guitar similar to T-Bone's guitar, not exactly the same but similar, with a tone that sort of replicated what T-Bone was doing, but he played more abbreviated licks that weren't so extended as T-Bone Walker's, and they were generally these two-note licks that everyone is familiar with. The minute you hear ba-da-da-da-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, that's Chuck Berry, and that was one of the introductions that he used in many of his tunes, and it's a two-note lick, not a single-note lick. And T-Bone Walker included that kind of approach to the guitar in his playing, and so Chuck heard that and listened to it. And of course he was influenced by many blues players, and then as Jim and Ed both mentioned, the hillbilly thing was really important. As a matter of fact, in 1955, when Muddy Waters recommended that Chuck go see Leonard and Phil Chess, they told him that for an audition they wanted to have him turn in a tape. So he immediately went off and made a tape, and the song that he wrote and became their first number one hit that actually helped Chess Records pay their blues artists was Maybelline. And Maybelline is based on a well-known country tune called Ida Red that was a hit for many, many Western swing bands like Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys and Spade Cooley. And it was a familiar melody, but Chuck changed the lyrics and contemporized them.
Mm-hmm. We'll hear some of that, and we'll also talk. We'll continue our tribute to Chuck Berry this hour. I want to hear from Ed about how he broke into the music business, somebody who was a beautician, what his early life was like growing up in St. Louis, and how you move along from one song to other songs into becoming who he is now. We hear his songs, and we all know the lyrics. Michael was talking about Maybelline. Here's a portion of it.
Can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started doing the things you used to do. As I was motivating over the hill, I saw Maybelline in a coupe de ville. A Cadillac rolling on an open road, nothing out to run my V8-4. A Cadillac doing about 95, bumper to bumper, rolling side to side. Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started back doing the thing you used to do. A Cadillac pulled up to 104. My phone got hot and wouldn't do no more. The gun got cloud and started to rain. I tooted my horn for the passing lane. The rainwater blowing all under my hood. I knew that I was doing my motor good. Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started back doing the thing you used to do.
Maybelline. And would you say that that was a first hit for him? Was it on the R&B charts, or what charts was it on? And how did it become a hit, Ed?
Well, I don't know how it became a hit, because that's all very murky back in those days. But it was his first record for Chess. And it had a lot of the things that were to characterize his work from there on. It's a narrative, and it's not particularly bluesy, but it's not particularly not bluesy. It's his style fully formed immediately right there. And once again, as we've said, it's based on a country tune, which was kind of his novelty shtick that he did when he was with the Jimmy Johnson Trio back in St. Louis. So it was a, you know, and also the other thing was that we were talking about cover versions. There were like five or six cover versions of that immediately, and none of them sold. None of them.
Hmm.
And that's, I think, as important as anything in the story, because Chuck Berry was all by himself a genre, and you couldn't imitate him, and you couldn't compete with him. He was who he was. End of story.
End of story, yeah.
He wasn't, you know, he wasn't coverable.
Who can tell me a little bit about, maybe all of you can, about his life growing up in St. Louis? He was a beautician, I understand. He got into quite a bit of trouble with the law, armed robberies, when he was a teenager. Spent some time in prison. Did he teach himself? Was he playing with neighborhood bands and they were playing in clubs? Or how do you become that good when you start your life as a beautician? Was he really wanting to do music and doing music on the side all of his life, early life? Anybody know?
His father was a carpenter, and both of his parents were musical, and he heard music when he was growing up. But I happen to have in front of me Chuck Berry's Greatest Hits that was printed in 1964.
Oh.
My original copy that cost me $2, and this was the first songbook of Chuck Berry's, and it says in the introduction there's some misinformation there. That is actually interesting, misleading. But since he was impressed with the guitar early on, and he saved up the amount of $4, and he bought himself a Spanish six-string guitar, and some instruction books, and he practiced after school. And he even mentioned his music teacher was named Mrs. Julia Davis. Realized how keen he was, and greatly encouraged him. And then Chuck started entertaining at house parties, etc. And he also, at the same time, his father tried to put him to work as a carpenter, house painter, with him, and he didn't take to that very well. So, yes, he did go to beautician school, and I prefer not to talk about his run-ins with the law that happened later, but he slowly started to play around the St. Louis area early on, and he decided to take a trip in May of 1955, and he went to Chicago. And he happened to visit a club where Muddy Waters was performing, and he spoke to Muddy during the only break that Muddy had at that gig, and he introduced himself and asked Muddy for advice, and Muddy was impressed with his enthusiasm, and suggested that Chuck look up the Chess Brothers.
I think Muddy heard him in a club in St. Louis originally, and then he said, if you're ever in Chicago, you know, come look me up.
Hmm. And so indeed he did. He looked him up. That's kind of an amazing story, isn't it? It always points to somebody's got to give you a break, right? Somebody looks over you, and here it was, of all people, Muddy Waters, who gave him that kind of break. We're going to welcome phone calls. We are paying tribute to Chuck Berry this hour of our program, who died at the age of 90 last Saturday. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. It's hard. It's amazing how you remember the lyrics, even those these songs. You may not have even grown up in that era of the 1950s in early 60s, but people know these songs, and you immediately get up and dance to them. So we're talking about why he is so prominent in the whole history of music in this country, particularly rock and roll. There are a number of performers who are influenced by him. We'll talk about that as we continue, and welcome your thoughts about Chuck Berry. This is the Ideas Network.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile. My curiosity running wild. Cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go.
Chuck Berry's life is what we're talking about this hour. And we have three guests with us. Ed Ward is a radio commentator, a writer. He's known as Public Radio's rock and roll historian. He has a new book, The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920 to 1963. Professor Tim Miller is joining us in our studios. He's a professor in the Department of Music at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, teaches musicology and ethnomusicology. And Michael Hawkeye Herman is with us. He's a blues music performer, composer, songwriter, educator, historian, and journalist, and the recipient of the International Blues Foundation's Lifetime Achievement Award for his work in keeping the blues alive through education. Welcoming phone calls for all of our guests, 800-486-8655 is our number, and let's go to some phone calls, starting with Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Well, good afternoon, Kathleen. In the 1950s, early 50s, my mother ran a restaurant in a small village. Then about 1956, I think it was about then, she bought a Seaberg jukebox, a secondhand one, and got it repaired and brought it up to snuff. Then she started buying the records to all the artists that were coming out, like Chuck Berry, the Beatles, the Johnny Cash, Elvis Presley, and putting those songs on a jukebox. Then what she'd do on a Saturday afternoon or Saturday night, when we didn't have a dance here in town, she'd slide the tables out of the way, put a couple of knuckles in a jukebox, and let the teenagers dance. And they'd slug that in jukebox all night long. they were dancing to that music, and boy, that was good music.
Yeah, it was great dancing music, and it's part of Chuck Berry, really. You can't sit down when you hear some of these songs, Tim, can you?
No, that's part of what rock and roll is. It's a music that's centered on moving. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the big distinctions that its detractors were making to it, but it's ultimately a big part of why it survived. And
it's interesting that he seemed to capture this whole teenage experience, or maybe he helped to create the teenage experience, I don't know. But he sings about cars, he sings about school, he sings about driving around in a car with a girl after school with no particular place to go. We heard part of that song earlier. And he sings about other things, too. He sings about race issues, although they're not front and center. Tell me why he sang about what he sang and how he made it more than trivial. The lyrics weren't trivial, really.
Well, yeah, and that's one of those things you look to sometimes as the vestiges of country music, which has always been a narrative-based form. And the stories he was telling had that authenticity that, you know, that's a word we use very carefully, but for a lot of people, that's what they're looking for, this sense that it is real, mm-hmm. the sense that this is a real person we're dealing with. Even if he's not telling exactly his story, it's close enough to imagine, when you listen to Johnny B. Goode, that this is his story. You know, he could play guitar, and he was waiting, he had his break, and now his name is in lights. And just to circle back to what we were saying about his guitar playing, another part of what rock was, it was a music that was accessible not only to people to listen to dance, but also to play. And so if you look at his guitar innovations, they're not really all that technical. Like Michael talked about some really great technical language about how we can describe it. But it's not something that's tremendously difficult. And that's really the mark of a great innovator. They can do something that's not too flashy, not too technical, but make it sound fresh, and then all of a sudden everybody wants to do it. And if you've done something that everybody can kind of do if they try a little bit, it's a very powerful way to get yourself into mm-hmm. the idea of the music.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to just add, I saw just on the day Chuck Berry died, they've played a bunch of interviews with him, and one of the things that he said, you were talking about the culture and etc., is that he was very shrewd and he was very aware of what was going on. And I'm paraphrasing what he said, but he said in this interview that black music, which was known as race music or R&B, at that time was spilling over into white culture. While at the same time, interestingly enough, in the post-World War II era, when America was growing so much as a result of winning the war and the industries, etc., before that, there was no teenage culture. There weren't teenagers driving around in cars so much. They didn't have money in their pockets before the war. And after the war, the U.S. was so successful in riding this high that we had now had a teenage culture with that was unique to itself. That's where those movies with James Dean, et cetera, come from. They're documenting a change in American culture, where now all of a sudden we have a teenage culture with kids with money in their pocket, and they can buy cars, and they can drive around. And Chuck Berry had his fingers on the pulse of that.
Well, I have to contest that because it's simply not true that teenage culture is a post-war phenomenon. I know that I have written a lot saying that it was, but there's a remarkable book called Teenage by a guy named John Savage, who is a British writer and observer of popular culture, and it completely disproves that notion. What Chuck Berry did that was very interesting, though, was as a sort of outsider, and certainly somebody who was older than the people he was writing to, he managed to somehow tell the truth about what it was like to be a teenager right now.
Right.
And that was the thing that was remarkable. I mean, don't forget, he was born in 1926. He was 30 years old when his great period of recording started. And I mean, 30. I mean, God, he was only 6 years younger than my mother.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, Ed, in this very first songbook that I have, that was one of the misleading things that they say is that that he was born in 1931, and they knew that he wasn't born in 1931. But in this songbook, the first one of Chuck Berry's that came out in 1964, they cheated on his age to make him seem 5 years younger.
Right.
So he appeared to be closer in age. And when I said there wasn't a teenage culture, I didn't mean it so parochially. What I mean was it wasn't documented and so marketable as it had become in the post-World War II era.
Well, keep thinking of Sinatra's Bobby Soxers, though.
Yeah, the Bobby Soxer. And Chuck had his fingers on the pulse of that sweet little 16. She's got to have half a million autographs. And he documents in school day what it was like to be in school, and as was related as well, there's a great song that Chuck wrote called Promised Land that has racial overtones about breaking. They were a drive all the way from the East Coast to California and breaking down in Birmingham at the time and in Alabama. And those are allusions to the racial issues that were going on in the South, and he couldn't wait to get across Mississippi clean.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so he did allude to those things, but you had to be aware of what was going on in our culture at the time. So I wouldn't say
there's a number of his other songs, you know, Brown Eyed Handsome Man. I'm not sure that eyes were the only thing on that guy that was brown. And there's also Too Much Monkey Business about unreasonable demands put on you at work, and you know, it seems like it's just a teenager who's working at this gas station, but really, it could be any young black man too, because that's about as high as responsible a job as he's going to get.
And that's part of the genius of the songwriting that he does is that he, as has been said, he was very shrewd, and you know. We have all these stories, and it's hard to separate the fact from the legend, but that the original line in Johnny B. Goode was, lived a colored boy, and then he changed it to country boy. And so he's somebody who could look at this, at you know, the reality of the market and go like, well, I can talk about my own experiences, but if I change this and I change this, then all of a sudden it's open to other people to hear their own experiences. So he's managing to pull off this trick of speaking to somewhat to a black audience, somewhat to a white audience, and people can imagine themselves through any of these lyrics.
Yeah. Let's go to more phone calls. Eugene, thanks for yours. Jack in the North Woods. Hi, Jack.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Great show. I had a couple comments. First, I learned to love Chuck Berry, although I heard him as a young boy in the car. I got turned on to him from Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead, mm-hmm. and Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones. I just loved the licks, and I learned to love Chuck. I was wondering if your guests could address Chuck's great piano player, Johnny Johnson, who actually sued Chuck for some of the copyrighted material. I think it was 2000. He lost the lawsuit, and Chuck ended up blaming Keith Richards and Bull Diddley, I believe. But he didn't hold any hard feelings. But Keith claims that a lot of Chuck's guitar chords were piano chords, and that he realized that Johnny Johnson, who was, I guess, a serious alcoholic and somewhat of a savant musician, may have helped Chuck compose some of those songs.
I'd seen Johnny Johnson play in the post-Chuck Berry years, and you're absolutely right. Johnny Johnson, many of the figures that Chuck plays that seem signature on the guitar were right-handed licks that Johnny Johnson used in his piano playing. And I'd like to just quickly throw in a hilarious anecdote that Keith Richards tells himself, that was in Guitar Player magazine many years ago. Keith Richards idolized Chuck Berry from the very beginning and inspired him to play the guitar. And the first time Keith Richards got to be on stage with him was at a festival in Long Beach in the 1970s. And he met Chuck backstage and asked if he could come on stage and play with him. And I remember Keith Richards is the one who tells this story. And Chuck invited him on stage to play, and when Chuck nodded at Keith Richards to take a solo, Keith Richards played ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and Chuck Berry kicked him off the stage. And Keith Richards said, "Good grief, I get to get on stage with my idol for the first time, and I stupidly played the Chuck Berry lick. I should have known better not to get on stage with the master, the guy that invented this lick, and play it." And he said eventually, you know, he apologized and got back into Chuck's good graces. But at the same time, it just shows you that's how influential he wanted his enthusiasm was overwhelming, and he wanted to show Chuck that he could do what he did. Aww. And a lot of people could do what Chuck did, but it's the joke about guitar players. They stand in the audience and say, "I can do that." But that was Chuck Berry that he was playing. And so Keith Richards said, "So there I was with my, you know, on stage with my idol for the first time, and he kicked me off the stage."
Well, let's talk about some of the other people who were greatly influenced by him. You mentioned Keith Richards. What about the Beatles? What about Springsteen? What about Dylan? Ed?
Well, I don't know. Those are much later in the story. Back when Chuck Berry was starting, I also wanted to add that Chuck joined Johnny Johnston's band, not the other way around. Johnston needed a guitar player, and Chuck Berry auditioned for him, and he hired him. So no wonder the piano licks were, you know, reflected in the guitar licks. But you know, once Chuck Berry had happened, you couldn't get the genie back in the bottle. So anybody who played rock and roll subsequently had to acknowledge the fact of his existence and his influence. Anybody who was going to play rock and roll had to be conversant with Chuck Berry's output and his immense catalog and his attitude and everything else.
Mm-hmm. But did he influence future musicians, Keith Richards, Bob Dylan, the Beatles?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what I say. If you're going to play rock and roll, you have to acknowledge that he exists. And that acknowledgement comes in the form of acknowledging his influence and his making it possible for you to do what you're doing. If you're playing rock and roll, you're doing it in large part because Chuck Berry crossed racial and class lines at a time when it was very dangerous to do that, and made rock and roll both heartwarmingly familiar and dangerous at the same time.
Tim?
That's spot on. And the thing is, there's all these ephemeral things that are involved in this influence. So, you know, you can't really go through and say, well, you know, this guy played exactly like Chuck Berry or wrote exactly like Chuck Berry, because you'll find little bits of that, because every other person that came after is doing the same thing Chuck Berry did, which was assembling bits and bits and bits that are going. And so it's these big picture things like being your own author, speaking to this multivalent audience through the way you're writing songs and allowing for what we might call different subject positions to come into it, if we're going to really get scholarly on it. Really, the vibe and the showmanship, and that's something we haven't really talked about because, you know, we're on the radio, but the visuals of Chuck Berry. And if you look at guitar players' sense, even if they're not playing his licks, because anybody who sheds on the guitar can surpass that. And again, that's part of the genius of an innovator like that. He's doing everything, and so his guitar solos are at whatever level. You get a specialist like, you know, Steve Vai or Eddie Van Halen come in, they could play. They'll acknowledge Chuck Berry's greatness, and then they'll play many more notes, many fast passages. But the way he held the guitar, the way he moved on stage, and just like Elvis, because this is right around the same time, that this breaking of the physical taboo of, you know, moving your hips on stage. I mean, this is not something that had been brand new, but to really have it foregrounded by television, foregrounded by the way album packaging was developing, that kind of physicality of performance is a really important thing that Berry contributed to the legacy of rock.
Mm. You mentioned Brown-Eyed Handsome Man. I want to play part of this song with an ear for and set it up for us, please, Michael and Ed. The elements of race in this song, what should we listen for?
Well, I think go ahead, the coded lyric.
Yeah. I think he's pretty out front about it, and I think one of the most telling aspects is the courtroom scene,
right? And the line "arrested on charges of unemployment,"
right?
That so, is so a I think, true I think that, racial code.
Here's Chuck Berry, Brown-Eyed Handsome Man.
Of unemployment, he was sitting in the witness stand. The judge's wife called up the district attorney. She said, "Free that brown-eyed man. If you want your job, you better free that brown-eyed man." Flying across the desert in a TWA, I saw a woman walk across the sand. She'd been walking 30 miles en route to Bombay to meet a brown-eyed handsome man. Her destination was a brown-eyed handsome man. Way back in history, 3,000 years, in fact, ever since the world began, there's been a whole lot of good women shedding tears over a brown-eyed handsome man. It's a lot of trouble with a brown-eyed handsome man. She had the world in the palm of her hand. She lost both her arms in a wrestling match to meet a brown-eyed handsome man. She fought and won herself a brown-eyed handsome man. 2-3 the count, with nobody on, he hit a high fly into the stand. Round the third, he was headed for home. It was a brown-eyed handsome man that won the game. It was a brown-eyed handsome man.
Was this song it?
I don't know.
Does anybody know what year it was?
I'll come up with it in a second. Hold on.
Yeah, okay. And you know what I just realized, since I haven't heard this in a while, is that last verse was about Jackie Robinson.
That's right.
Who was the first black baseball player in the major leagues.
Huh.
1956.
Wow.
Okay, I wanted to just add that because as we were listening to those two-note licks that he was playing so fluidly, T-Bone Walker was a great dancer.
Oh, yeah.
He did the splits on stage while playing the guitar. There are photos of him. And he played the guitar behind his back and behind his head long before Chuck Berry, long before Stevie Ray Vaughan. The women used to just fall out when they saw T-Bone Walker play. They called him Daddy Bone. and he played a guitar that was similar to what Chuck Berry played. The last thing I'll say, I was fortunate to see T-Bone Walker play, and he played, when he played the guitar and played a solo, he always played with the back of the guitar parallel to the ground, which no one else did. In other words, the guitar was flat like a table in front of him, even when he was standing up. And later on in his life, he didn't dance so much, but he was known as not only a great guitar player, but also a fantastic dancer that added that aspect to the music, and Chuck took it to the next level.
Mm-hmm. Well, he sure did. It's great to watch him dancing. I read somewhere, Tim, that particular song that we didn't hear, that kind of story, which was telling an important message again until Bob Dylan.
Well, you know, it's hard to speak in absolutes like that, but there certainly was this period, and this gets into why we distinguish between rock and roll and rock sometimes. So you get Chuck Berry coming out, you get Elvis coming out, you know, we're talking after Bill Haley, so we're 1954 to 1957 or so. And then there's some more people coming out, Buddy Holly. And you get a moment where the music industry, who had kind of been short-circuited by this, so you get performers like Chuck Berry coming from the independents, like Chess, who aren't, I mean, Chess is fairly big for us now. They're very famous, but they don't have the same size and scope that the Decca and I'm trying to think of the actual correct period names for these organizations that have been around for a long time. But the majors. So they kind of take back over in 1959, 1960, 1961, and this is when the Brill Building happens, and we get this professionalization of rock and roll songwriting. And so this is when Lieber and Stoller are writing for the Coasters. So it's very similar story songs to that, but it's coming in with professional musicians. This is where Phil Spector comes in with his production. And so then it flips kind of backwards with the Beatles getting back to self-authored. And then, yeah, Dylan comes in, and we get a stronger emphasis on message songs. Mm-hmm. But remember that Dylan's coming from folk, where they've been doing it.
Right.
After the House Un-American Activities Committee and the Weavers were basically shut down. So by the early 1960s, you're getting more politically active songs. I mean, 1963 is Kennedy, and that's when Paul Simon writes Sound of Silence. And so we're getting back into that. And that comes along with this second wave of people doing what Berry started with his writing original music, speaking about their own experiences. And it's just amplifying it to another level of awareness of what's going on around. And that just goes with some of the rest of what's going on in the 60s.
Paying tribute to Chuck Berry this hour of the program and welcoming your phone calls. We'll have time for a few more as we carry on here. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Hour two of our program today, we're going to be talking about the difficult relationship between the press and the Trump administration. And we invite you to join us tonight at 7 for an hour-long recap of the Senate judiciary proceedings from NPR. Special coverage will be hosted by Ari Shapiro with legal analysis from NPR correspondent Nina Totenberg and many other people. So that's tonight at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Long-distance information, give me Tennessee, help me find the party, trying to get in touch with me. She could not leave her number, but I know who placed the call, 'cause my uncle took the message and he wrote it on the wall. Help me, information, get in touch with my Marie. She's the only one who'd phone me here from just a half a mile from the Mississippi Bridge.
Memphis by Chuck Berry. Anybody want to comment on that song before we go back to phone calls?
1959.
That song was not a hit. That's what really blows my mind.
59. It was not a hit.
It was not a hit.
It was
never
a B-side.
Yeah. He had so much. He had so many great songs. They just threw them away.
Michael.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I think that song was copyrighted in 1959, and the interesting thing about that particular tune is that it actually became an instrumental hit because of the uniqueness of the guitar part. As a guitar player, I can tell you, I think it was Lonnie Mack that actually did an instrumental version of Memphis, and it was totally recognizable as Chuck Berry's Memphis, Tennessee, but he took the guitar licks that you're hearing there and played them instrumentally without the words. For that Chuck Berry song, the words were not necessary. Let's just say they were not used, and people covered it as an instrumental, which many of his other tunes were not. He didn't do that many instrumentals. Like, he did one called Deep Feeling that I recorded, and a couple of others that actually replicates the steel guitar, which Chuck could play the steel guitar. But surprisingly, what I'll say about Memphis, Tennessee, is just to reiterate, is that guitar aspect in that song was so recognizable that it was recorded by many people as a standard instrumental in rock and roll, and I think Lonnie Mack had the major hit with it.
Hmm. Let's go to Peter in Glendale. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I'd like to pay tribute to Ed. I've taught rock history for over 25 years at Alverno College, and I always assign the students the Teenage Nation chapter from Rock of Ages. So very much appreciate what he's written over the years.
Thanks.
I'm interested in a little more talk about how the blues provided the platform for 90% of Chuck's songs and what he added to the blues to make it more rock and roll.
Michael, you want to take that? You're a blues performer.
I spend a lot of time teaching blues master classes and blues in the schools programs. And blues music originally was linear in its earliest phases, and then it became a 12-bar format, an AAB poetry format, which means that you say a line, you repeat it, and that's AA, and then you have a rhyming line like Sweet Home Chicago. Come on, baby, don't you want to go? A. Come on, baby, don't you want to go? A. From the land of California to my sweet home Chicago. That's the B line. So a lot of the formula of blues music was the 12-bar AAB poetry format, and that's what allowed jazz musicians to learn how to improvise, because you learned that format, and there were so many tunes that went to that format, and country music used that format too, and Chuck was influenced by that, and what I'm saying is he listened to Muddy Waters and to Lightnin' Hopkins and to early blues guys, and he heard that format, and that allowed him entree into being able to play the guitar in a fashion that he could eventually stretch out on and not necessarily use that AAB 12-bar format. Some of his songs do have a 12-bar format, as well as Hank Williams Sr. used that format as well, but they hid the AAB format within by sophisticating it or switching it around or changing it. So Chuck was deeply influenced by the blues music, because as with many musicians, the standard blues format, the poetic format and the musical chord format, allows people a regular form that they're familiar with that gives them a repertoire of music that they can stretch out on and eventually stretch out of.
Thanks, Peter. John in Elkhorn, hi.
Hi. I'm going to we'll go out on talking about Chuck's personality. I understand in periods of his life that Chuck was a rather peculiar individual. Bruce Springsteen has told the story of early on in his career that he backed up Chuck Berry on a couple of occasions. And the story is something like, you know, I'm Chuck Berry. Everybody knows my music. I don't need a band. We'll just get the band from the local area. They all know my music. And then the second part was, I don't take a stage until I have the cash in hand.
Yeah, he wanted to always be paid in cash. That's my understanding, Ed. Yours as well?
Yeah, those are the standard stories. But he was right, every band did know his music. And so he never did rehearsals. He never did sound checks. It was, you know, if they didn't know it, well, then he would fire them on the stage. I was talking to somebody the other day who the entire band got fired except for this one guy, and Chuck did the rest of the tour with this one guy as his band.
On that note, we have to say goodbye. Would it be Johnny B. Goode? Let me ask each of you yes or no, or give me another choice that you would have sent into deep space. Tim?
Well, that's,
I think that's a no-brainer, yeah.
That would be yes. Ed?
Yeah, it's iconic, you know. It wraps it all up.
Yeah. Michael?
I agree. There's so many great Chuck Berry songs, but that one's probably the pinnacle because it talks about, we assume that the narration is about him and rock and roll and how it all happens.
Thank you all very much for being with us. Our thanks to Ed Ward, who is author most recently of The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920-63. Tim Miller, professor in the Department of Music at UW-Milwaukee. Michael Hawkeye Herman, blues music performer, composer, songwriter, educator, historian, and journalist. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and Colleen Duvall, he's dancing in the other room, for on-air production.
Roll over Beethoven, dig these rhythm and blues.